Last week I gave a report on a new scientific discovery about a supernova. And the amazing thing is how these supernova correlate with what's called the long summer. And for those of you that missed it, let me just go through this really quickly, then we'll move on. That, we're living in what's called an ice age cycle. And the Earth has only had one ice age cycle, basically for the last 2.58 million years. We've had ice ages before, but never an ice age cycle. To get an ice age cycle, the planet has to be delicately balanced so it can oscillate between ice and a warm interglacial. That takes incredible fine-tuning to make that happen, and it's only existed for the last 2.58 million years. So what were other ice ages like? These are ice ages that lasted millions of years, not something that really would be conducive to advanced life. But for the last 2.58 million years, we've had these ice ages, where you get a period of ice covering a lot of the continental land masses, and you get a warm interglacial. However, it's only been the last 800,000 years that we've had an ice age cycle with a period of 100,000 years. What was the cycle like before that? 41,000 years. And as I mentioned before in this class, there's a reason why it can be 41,000 or 100,000. The 41,000 is driven by the variation in the tilt of Earth's orbit, the tilt relative to the solar system plane. And that varies a little bit, and that actually drives a climate variation. But the cycle we're in now is dominated by the variation, very slight variation, in the shape of Earth's orbit. And that is a 100,000-year cycle, whereas the tilt of the orbit's plane has a 41,000-year cycle of variation. And it shifted from 41,000 years to 100,000 years, starting 800,000 years ago. What drove that shift? Yes, go ahead.
I'm just curious, the term ice age, everyone's talking about global warming.
Yes.
Does it include that in it, the warming period?
Well, what's interesting about the ice age cycle is the temperature warms and cools, warms and cools. What's extremely unusual is what we're having right now, where the temperature is not changing. Has never happened before in the past 2.58 million years. This is the only ice age cycle we're in where we've had a constant warm temperature. And if I could pull up this slide, let's see. Here we go.
So that's warm enough that it's causing more to melt than they think that has to melt.
Well, let me pull up another slide here. Let me see if I can get this back here for you. Here we go. Ah. All right, I'm not going to be able to pull it, so I'll come up with one that's not so good, but it'll do the purpose. Here we go. If you just look at the red one and the blue one at the top, it kind of shows you what the last four ice age cycles have been like, where you get a long period, about 80 to 90,000 years of an ice age, followed by what's called a warm interglacial. But what you'll notice about the warm interglacials, the temperature spikes up to a maximum and then drops down quickly into an ice age. And what's unusual about the current ice age is instead of spiking up to a maximum and dropping down, it stops short of the maximum and has stayed there for 9,000 years. That's what's called the long summer, although it would be better to refer to it as the long warm spring. Or to show you in more detail, this is the last ice age maximum that occurred about 125,000 years ago, where it jumped up to a temperature that was about 7 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than it is today. Warm enough that Ellesmere Island up by the North Pole was ice-free. It actually had an average temperature of like 55 degrees. That's how warm it got. But when it hit that maximum, the temperature rapidly dropped down into an ice age. The one exception of all the ice age cycles we've had over the past 2.58 million years is the one we're in right now. The one we're in right now, the ice age ended about 13,000 years ago, and then the temperature jumped up to a maximum, which hit that plateau 9,000 years ago, and it's basically stayed there for the last 9,000 years. But that temperature, what's referred to as the long warm spring, happens to be optimal for global human civilization. That is the best possible temperature, and has been staying there constant for 9,000 years. Yes.
Are these graphs on the website anywhere?
Yeah, you'll find them. I mean, it's on my Facebook page. There's also an article on the Reasons page, which shows these graphs. They're public domain. If you just put in ice age cycles into your search engine, they'll pop up. So, in fact, let me jump you to... here we go. What this shows you is that this isn't just an anomaly in the Greenland ice cores. You actually see it as well in the Antarctic ice cores. All the ice cores, and now there's a new paper that's been published that's showing a sediment core in the North Atlantic area. So this is well below where the ice ages hit. It's also showing the same temperature variation, where we get this long, warm spring for the last 9,000 years. And it's actually steadier in the northern hemisphere than it is in the southern hemisphere, which is a good thing because most of the continental landmass is in the northern hemisphere or along the equator. And so we've been the beneficiaries of this extremely stable, optimal temperature. By the way, no scientist really knows why this is going on. It's something that's being investigated, but we don't have a clear answer as to why we're so blessed, other than the fact that maybe God's behind all this and just seemed to engineer it just right, and we're ready to launch civilization. He kept it nice and constant for these past 9,000 years. And this graph down here actually shows you what conditions were like before the 12,000 years ago when civilization got launched, how the temperature was jumping up and down rapidly. We now know this is a global phenomenon. We also know that if you go back into the last warm interglacial, the temperature was jumping up and down just as radically as we see here. And so even during the last warm interglacial, there would have been no opportunity to launch and sustain civilization. Now, it doesn't mean that humans living in this era were not able to farm. What it does mean, however, is we're talking small mixed farms. So if the climate changes, you could move your farm and go somewhere else. It basically forced humanity into a nomadic lifestyle, or a lifestyle where it just simply didn't make any sense to build roads or to specialize and trade with one another because the climate would change so radically, it would simply disrupt the economy. Yes?
Can you tell what the temperatures might have been at that time?
Yes. Let me pull up. Okay. When we're down about here, the temperature is 8 or 9 degrees centigrade colder than it is right now. And that will translate into about 15 to 16 degrees colder than it is now. So.
Than today or?
Pardon me? Compared to today, yeah.
Okay.
So whatever mean temperature you have, drop it by, say, 15, 16, 17 degrees. That's what it was like back then. But the real problem is the temperature is going up and down. I mean, we're talking significant climate changes that are taking place in a century or two. And this explains why agriculture was impossible until we have this nice steady temperature we can count on. Then it makes sense to actually have a large farm where all you do is grow wheat, and someone else has a large farm where all they do is raise goats. Another city would have, say, a pottery industry, and where everybody would be engaged in making pottery and various cooking utensils, and then people would trade. And they'd have roads, or they would have caravans where they would trade with one another. That requires a stable climate. Without a stable climate, that simply can't be done. In fact, a paper got published just 3 months ago saying agriculture was impossible, but also making the point, which I thought was really interesting, the paper, not only is agriculture impossible when the climate is changing this radically, but they're also claiming that given the nature of humanity, once the climate becomes stable, it's inevitable that agriculture will be launched. It just says, if you just look at the psyche of humanity, it's such that it would guarantee that large-scale agriculture would be launched the moment there would be a stable temperature. So I thought that was kind of interesting. Here we have these climatologists working on it, but they actually brought some sociologists in to help them with the research, basically making the point that if you actually examine how we human beings are motivated, we're so extremely motivated to invent and to create that as soon as conditions are favorable, we will do it. So we will build a road if we know the road isn't going to be destroyed within a few weeks or a few months. Although, hey, I've been back east where they have two climates, winter and construction. So maybe...
Winter and what?
Construction.
Winter and construction. And two, a couple of things. If I'm correct, Mark, archaeology, the oldest known city, I believe, is Jericho. And that goes back to about something like 8500 BC, I think, which is interesting in light of what you're showing up there.
Yeah, let me pull this graph up again, a more detailed one.
But the second part, while you're doing
it, here we go.
The first graph that you showed, where we're up there for about 9,000 years, yeah, what does that one belief that goes way up there and then goes immediately back down?
Okay, that little blip that you see there, that only shows up in one ice core. If you look at the other ice cores, it doesn't show up. So it means that that particular region had a temperature blip. But that's why I showed you this particular graph where you got to see four. If you average those out, that's kind of what we get. And, you know, it's... So this showed up in the, I think, I'm trying to remember which... This is the Vostok Ice Age. So this is Antarctica, what you're looking at. It's not Greenland. So I mentioned before, if you look at the Greenland ice cores, it shows greater stability than you do in Antarctica. Not at all surprising, because what we're seeing during this long, warm spring is a time when the northern hemisphere is closest to the sun in the wintertime. So the fact that, and see, there's a third cycle. It's called the precession cycle, how the rotation of the Earth's axis actually does this over the course of 26,000 years. So it's spinning like this. It's like a rapidly spinning top, but it does this. I mean, for example, the North Star is Polaris, but 13,000 years from now, the North Star is going to be Vega. And, you know, if you know anything about your sky, Vega's quite a ways away. So the angle that the precession is significant. But it is such that 13,000 years from now, the northern hemisphere will be farthest from the sun in the wintertime. Now, what that does is it makes the climate variation from summer to winter more extreme. But right now, we're closest. In fact, I put this on my Facebook page. I think it was July 3rd is when we were farthest from the sun. So that means that our summers are cooler than they otherwise would be, and our winters are warmer. And that's a good thing if you want to have, you know, stable civilization. Unfortunately, we live on a planet where almost all the land mass is either above the equator or very close to the equator. And therefore, most of us have the benefit of having relatively cool summers and warm winters. It explains why Antarctica is a much more severe place to live. Notice we really don't have much civilization in Antarctica. That there's no permanent habitation there. I think there's 5,000 people that spend time there, but they're not there all at once. There was a gal who came to this class once who spent 2 years at the South Pole. But so that's about the max amount of time they let you spend there. And, you know, she was mentioning how, you know, for months at a time you can't go outside. The weather is so severe. Say, how severe? 100 degrees below zero and 100 mile per hour winds. And it's because of the wind you don't want to go outside.
What's the wind chill factor?
Well, you can calculate the wind chill factor, but her comment was the greatest danger of being outside there, number one, your body gets chilled extremely quickly, but with 100 mile per hour winds, you get this whiteout where you can only see maybe 18 inches away from you. You can't even see your feet. And so you get disoriented very easily, and you could wind up walking away from your survival hut rather than towards it. So you basically just stay inside. By the way, she had to take a psychological exam before they let her go there. Yeah, go ahead.
At 100 mile an hour wind, the force on your body would equal your body weight.
Yeah.
Close to it.
Yeah.
So whatever you weigh, that's how far what the wind is like. And then when it died off, what would happen to you?
Well,
I've
been in mountain climbs where I had to face a 60 mile per hour wind, and what you do is you lean into the wind. But if the wind were to stop, you'd just fall flat in your face. That's how, I mean, you got to lean way over to counter that wind. And yeah, when it's 100 miles per hour, you really can't lean enough to, especially if it's gusting. I mean, it's just, you just don't want to be around. So never mind the wind chill factor. So. But yeah, this is the great mystery of climatology, why this current ice age isn't like the previous ice ages. Now, this is a little bit off topic. Let me get back to where I really want to take you, and then we'll move on. Okay, last week we made the comment that isn't it interesting that we've got this unique long, warm spring where the global temperatures are optimal for launching and sustaining civilization. Yes. You made mention about the oldest villages. The oldest...
Jericho, I think, is 8,500 years old. I think the oldest known... I don't know if you want to call it a city, but...
Well, there's something referred to as a Neolithic Revolution,
yes,
which is the first time we see specialized agriculture and where we see industry, you know, like pottery making, and then a trading system. That dates back to 12,000 years ago. Okay, so 12,000 years ago, and where you see this is in the Mesopotamian plain, and particularly up against the mountains that surround Mesopotamia, and then around the Persian Gulf. This is where you see the oldest villages. Now, we're talking a village. I really do mean a village. We're talking just a few buildings, and that's it. But what you would see would be village A. They would simply grow grain. They would do nothing but grow grain. And they would have miles, square miles, where they would grow grain. And then there'd be another village where they would raise goats. And then they would literally raise thousands of goats. And then you have another village that would be making utensils, like pottery. And yeah, I saw your hand go up as a pottery manufacturer here in this class. I mean, if you want to see some amazing pottery, check out. Anyway, what would happen is that you'd get these three villages, and they would trade with one another. You know, I'll give you grain if you give me goats and pottery. And then the people, and you know, this is interesting. You actually have a village where they grow no food at all, but what they're counting on is the fact that they can get food by trading manufactured goods with them.
That's called the barter system.
It's the barter system. That's the first time we see trade. It begins about 12,000 years ago. Now, once you get outside of the Persian Gulf, we're looking at a much later launch of civilization. There's reasons why we see it birthing there first. And by the way, the Bible is consistent with that. It talks about the birth of civilization in that particular region of the world. Now, the temperature was rising there, but was rising in a consistent way that people could predict. And by the way, the Neolithic Revolution was nothing like what we're experiencing today. What you basically got is people evolving from having, say, a small mixed farm of a couple of acres. So, I mean, if you're back in this era, that's what's happening. People might have tried to take a couple of acres. They'd be gathering food. They'd be hunting animals. And then they'd be growing a few crops. And basically, producing everything they need for the family. And when the climate changes, they just pull up their tents and their animals and they move somewhere else. And so with a nomadic lifestyle, they could survive. Now, we don't see evidence of that. In terms of archaeological evidence for that lifestyle, it doesn't exist for good reason. What we have is a level of civilized activity that is such that it's not going to leave discoverable artifacts. I mean, once you get people specializing in growing nothing but grain, what you'll notice is that will actually change the DNA of the grain. So that's how they discovered the launch of civilization. They basically looked at the DNA and watched how it evolved from being wild to being cultured. Because if you're growing square miles of wheat, then you're going to be highly motivated to breed the wheat so it's more productive, or the corn so it's more productive. And so they looked for the DNA signature of that breeding, and they found it and were able to date it. And likewise with goats. How they did that is they basically compared the skeletal piles, because they would actually see this place where there'd be a whole bunch of goat bones. Okay, if you got a whole bunch of goat bones in one place, chances are somebody was specializing with goats. And the other thing they notice is that the bones of the female goats were a lot older in terms of the age when the animal died compared to the males. That again was a signature that this was being exploited, in the sense that if you've got male goats, you keep them alive long enough that they can reproduce with the females, but then you kill them for meat. Whereas the females are going to keep producing, kids and keep producing milk, so there's actually an economic advantage to allowing the females to live longer than the males. And that's how they detected, well, there must have been some specialized goat agriculture going on, because you can actually see the difference in the skeletons of the males compared to the females. And then likewise, they found villages where they found a huge amount of cracked pieces of pottery. And given the quantity of the pottery, they said this must have been a village where that was all they were doing, just given the great variety and the different uses. So that's how they basically dated the Neolithic Revolution. Now, all that means that these activities were going on before. It's just that you're not going to discover them until you get sufficiently large specialization that's actually going to leave discoverable remains. So, for example, if a family is making some pots in their backyard, chances are you're not going to find any evidence of those pots. Why? Because, yeah, you'll find pieces, but not in sufficient quantity that you can actually say that this is evidence for what was going on. So people are always asking me, why don't we have any evidence for people before the flood were doing? Well, the population was small, and everybody was just simply trying to produce everything their family needed. That will not leave discoverable remains. Yeah, question back here.
Also, just thinking about people living on the planet, first of all, in the 20 to 40,000 year range, I assume it had to be really pretty much equatorial because within a few degrees of the equator, because of the dynamic, first of all, the coolness, 15 degrees down is equal to a whole very cold winter. So also the dynamics, you see most of that life all of a sudden wondering, the ones that could survive lived in caves, which were survivable at minus 50 degrees, 100 degrees. I'm wondering about that wide cycling and people surviving.
Well, what's interesting is you actually do see the birth of civilization right here, but still on a relatively small level. We're talking small villages that specialize and trade with one another. We're not talking cities. These are just villages, and they're all in one place. But the other thing that's interesting is where they are. Now, the Bible indicates that the Garden of Eden is a juncture of four rivers, the Persian Gulf. I won't go into that again. But where we do find the earliest evidence for the Neolithic Revolution is on the mountains that surround Mesopotamia and the Persian Gulf. And the advantage there is that if the climate changes, and say it's starting to get warmer, you simply move up in elevation. And if you've got, you know, and this is what happens, say, on the edge of the Mesopotamian plain, you've got mountains that gradually get higher and higher and higher, so it's easy to move your farms up. In fact, the earliest evidence they found for this is in the Karasat Mountains that are at the north end of the Mesopotamian plain, basically around where Nineveh is. Nineveh is basically at the top end of the Mesopotamian plain, and there you got the mountains of Ararat that gradually get to higher and higher elevations. But the whole point is you can farm all the way up. And so that'd be an ideal place to be if you're looking at this kind of a situation here. But notice what's happening here. Rather than temperature going up and down, it's steadily going up. So people could just be moving their villages to higher and higher elevations in response to the warming trend. And once it gets up here, they can stop moving and now they can build cities. And so this is where you begin to see the first large cities being built is starting about here and moving forward. Because now you're not going to have to move your villages. You can actually settle and build multi-story buildings and have dense population and really begin to have very large-scale civilization. So this is when you begin to get global civilization. Here you got civilization in a few isolated locations. And as the temperature goes up, it begins to spread. But not until here does it become a global event. What I was sharing with you last week, not only do we have this amazing long, warm spring, that long, warm spring is coincident with an outstanding supernova anomaly. And the supernova anomaly is this, is that if I go back here, during this period, I mean, humans are busy on planet Earth during this period. They're reproducing, they're making these little small farms. Here they're starting to have their villages. But during this era, we have several really significant supernova events. Supernova events that are going to be damaging in terms of trying to launch and sustain global civilization. But once you get up here, we don't have any nasty supernova events. You say, well, what's a nasty supernova event? Well, somebody was asking me last week, what would happen if the star Sirius were to go supernova? One day it will. And when it goes supernova, we'll be in serious trouble because it's only 8 light years away. If it goes supernova, we're all dead. Okay? It doesn't matter where you go, you're dead because of the proximity of that star. And you also asked me, are we actually aware of stars that are going to go supernova any time? There are 4 stars that we astronomers are watching that have the potential of going supernova in the next 10,000 years. I say, can you give us a more accurate date than that? No, we can't. Our models are not good enough. We just know it's going to be either tomorrow or 10,000 years from now that these stars will go supernova. Fortunately, none of them are so close to us that when they do go supernova, it would lead to the extermination of human beings. But a couple of them are close enough that it could significantly impact our technology. Yes. Yeah, if Sirius goes supernova, the radiation from that event will kill you. Now, there are ways to escape it. Somebody said, well, could we live in with a lead suit? Well, as long as your lead suit is 8 inches thick, you should be fine. But if it's 8 inches thick, you're going to be exposed to a lot of uranium decay because lead is the product of uranium decay and thorium decay. And wherever you got lead, you got some residual uranium and thorium inside the lead. So wearing a lead suit isn't an option, never mind the weight of the thing and the fact that lead is soft and it would sag. So although there is one way that you could escape a nearby supernova eruption, and that's to live in the middle of a salt mine. So if you put yourself a couple of thousand feet underground, there are actually salt deposits that are several thousand feet thick. If you want to drill down into that thing and carve out a little cavity there where you're surrounded by all this salt, it's a great deal because, number one, it protects you from the uranium and thorium decay in the crust of the earth. I mean, my mother's side of the family are coal miners. And when you're down in a deep coal mine, you get exposed to a lot more radiation than if you're living on the surface. They would tell me you could actually feel the heat from the radioactive decay and also the heat coming up from the center of the earth. And so, you know, they don't live as long because of the fact that they're exposed. I mean, they were coal miners. Coal has a lot of uranium and thorium in it. And incidentally, you actually release more radiation to the environment by burning coal than you do through nuclear fission power plants. So if you're really interested in trying to protect yourself from radiation, it's a good idea to switch from coal to nuclear power plants. That's just a bit of trivia. Okay, you still get some radiation, but it's less than you get with coal. But if you're in one of these little salt mine deposits, you could protect yourself from the uranium and thorium that's in the crust of the Earth, because salt doesn't have any uranium and thorium in it. And you also protect yourself from the deadly radiation coming from these supernova events. Almost all the cosmic rays that are zapping your body on a daily basis, on a minute-by-minute basis, come from supernova remnants. There are thousands of remnants of exploded supernova in our galaxy, and that's where most of our cosmic rays come from. Fortunately, most of those cosmic rays are electrons and protons. And being hit by electrons and protons from these supernova remnants really isn't going to do you that much damage. The stuff that does the damage would be the heavy nuclei, fast-moving cosmic rays, and that's what's going to happen if Sirius goes supernova. You're going to be struck immediately by these very deadly cosmic rays. Yes?
Isn't that period too very short? It's at the burst of the supernova that it occurs and then it passes fast, right?
Yeah, you get an initial burst of radiation when a supernova explodes, and that burst will last for several months, and that radiation is especially deadly. Then after that, you get a background radiation from the expanding remnant that goes up from the supernova. And how long does that last? Oh, it lasts hundreds of thousands of years. And so we're being exposed by radiation from the thousands of supernova that exploded over the past several million years. And so that radiation takes a long time to subside. But unless the supernova remnant is close, it's not going to do you that much damage. Although it is such that if you live in Denver, you will live an average of 3 months less than if you live here at sea level. Because if you go up to a higher elevation, the atmosphere isn't as effective at absorbing the cosmic ray radiation. That's why I'm saying if you go in a coal or in one of these salt mines, you're sufficiently far enough below ground that the cosmic rays aren't going to damage you. And if you got salt all the way around you, you're not going to be bothered by the uranium and thorium. So if you want to live hundreds of years, vegetarian diet, go there. But hey, don't sweat it. You're not biochemically designed to live more than 120 years. But that would be one place to go if you're concerned about negating as much as possible the radiation damage to your body. I mean, you might make it to 120 years. But do you really want to live in the middle of a salt mine for the rest of your life? There's no internet access there. So. Yes?
Are there any mass extinction events that can definitively be traced to a supernova?
There are mass extinction events that can be traced to supernova eruptions, although mass extinction is a bit of an exaggeration, because the only way we can get a correlation is if the supernova exploded recently. And so what they've been doing is looking at supernova explosions that they can document over the past 2 million years. So probably the most dramatic event, and I'm trying to figure the exact date, it's either 1.8 million years ago or 2 million years ago, we can see a rodent mass extinction that they believe is tied to our solar system getting really close to what's called the it's the Centaurus Association of Very Bright Stars. And we're now sufficiently far away from it. It's not as dangerous as it was, but there was a time when we passed within less than 100 light years of that association of very bright young stars. And they believe that there could have been as many as a dozen of those stars that went supernova, and they've actually been able to correlate it with certain mammal extinction events. But it's nothing like what happened when the asteroid hit the Earth 65 million years ago. So, a kind of a little mass extinction event rather than a major mass extinction event. But yes, that can be documented. And by the way, when supernova do explode, they're most damaging to mammals. Land mammals. We land mammals get impacted the most by those events. So plants seem to survive quite well. Insects do quite well. Cockroaches do very well. But the mammals, and that's what they do. They look at rodents, and they can actually see certain extinction events for them. But yeah, these are the ones that have just been published by Firestone in the Astrophysical Journal. And what he was able to document was actually looking at carbon-14 analysis and looking at iron-60, which is an isotope that you get from a supernova. So when a supernova explodes, it showers us with these radioactive nickel, cobalt, and iron isotopes. And so what he did is he looked for those isotopes in the crust of the Earth. And by the way, these are isotopes that have decay half-lives of the hundreds of thousands of years. And so this technique is only useful for documenting relatively recent supernova events, which kind of pertains to your question. We can't go back in deep time, because if there is a supernova extinction, then we're not going to have the tools to say it's a supernova as opposed to something else. With one exception, if we do see a mass extinction event that only affects one hemisphere, then that would not be a supernova event. It would be what's called a gamma ray burst. Because a gamma ray burst, and we believe the gamma ray burst is generated by a very special kind of supernova. Sometimes it's referred to as a hypernova. So it's not just an ordinary supernova, but a really dramatic supernova event. And what that does is it produces a burst of gamma rays that lasts anywhere from 10 seconds to about 4 minutes. Now, the advantage for life on Earth, that's only going to impact one hemisphere. But if you can see in the fossil record, for example, that life was dramatically impacted in one hemisphere and was perfectly safe in the other hemisphere, then we look at that as a signature of a nearby gamma ray burst, because that would blast one hemisphere and leave the other hemisphere just fine. Yes?
I was just wondering, how is earthly life affected by something a little bit closer to home and maybe a little bit less dramatic, like a solar flare? Do we have any sort of impact on life, whether it's from smaller human life?
Okay. Solar flares were a big problem in the past. That will become a big problem in the future. Right now, we're living at the optimal solar flare moment in the history of the sun. Let me see if I can bring that graph up. I think I've shown this to the class here before. Is this it? Yeah, here we go. Another good reason to be alive now and not alive 5,000 or 10,000 years ago or 10,000 years hence. Now, keep in mind, this scale here is over 1 million. So up there we got solar flaring, and 1 million times more intense than we have today. But notice that we're living at the ideal solar flare moment, when solar flares are relatively few, and when they do go off, they're not all that damaging. And so the worst that's going to happen with a solar flare when you're at this moment in the history of the sun is it will knock out your satellite communications and make shortwave radio difficult to use, and a long-range radio as well, which according to my sons would be the end of civilization as we know it. But it's not going to be the end of humanity. However, as we move into the future, the sun is going to enter a stage in its burning history where the flaring is going to be a lot more intense. And we really only are talking a few tens of millions of years before it's really bad news for human beings. And likewise back here. There's a reason why God chose to create Adam and Eve when he did. This is a safe zone for humans and human civilization. Actually, for 20 different reasons. This is one reason. The Ice Age cycle is another reason. The long, warm spring is another reason. And now supernova are another reason. And I can go on. But as I said, there's lots of reasons why we're living in optimal time. I think you can tell where I'm going. Given that all these things are lining up at the same time, this can't be a cosmic accident. This is something that God planned literally billions of years ago, that he would actually shape the universe and our galaxy and our solar system so it would be this unique time window where everything lines up, where not only can humans exist, they can launch and sustain civilization. Okay, Here's a Bible question for all of you. Why would God want humans to be able to launch and sustain global high technology civilization?
To fulfill a great commission.
Very good. That's why he put us here, so we could take the good news of salvation through Jesus Christ to all the people and groups of the world. And I'll try to share you with this. I can't share with you next week. I'm going to be in North Carolina next week. But 2 weeks from today, I'm going to share with you some research done at the U.S. Center for World Mission, which shows you the impact that civilization has had on the fulfilling of the Great Commission. Another reason why it's so exciting for us to be alive in the 21st century. Literally, the fulfillment of the Great Commission has taken an exponential turn upward, but it's all thanks to the fact, well, not all thanks, but partly thanks to the fact that we've got the technology to take the Great Commission to farther reaches than we could in the past. And this required literally thousands of years of preparation. And one thing I'm also going to do, hopefully today, but maybe not, depending on the time, is actually take you through the Bible and show you how over the past 4,000 years, the strategies that we see the Bible in exhorting us to use to fulfill the Great Commission have changed in correlation with advancing civilization. So I'm making the point here. I think God intended that our civilization would advance through these previous 9,000 years to where we are today, given the fact that we see specific exhortations in the Bible that vary from Bible book to Bible book, correlating with how technology has advanced over the previous 9,000 years. Which was also the basis for what I said earlier about this research paper that claims that it's inevitable that once we have a stable climate, humans will launch civilization because we're driven to do that. We're driven to advance technology. I mean, what really excites us is to be able to take things farther than our parents' generation were able to take us. It's like we're compelled. Or to put it this way, we are, I'm trying to think of the psychological term, we are obsessed with advancing technology. I look at my sons, I can see that obsession. But I look at my own life and realize what it was like when I was born and what it's like today. I mean, the world has dramatically changed just in one lifetime. But that's the way it's been. That's one thing where we're different from the animals. You know, when biologists try to claim we're descended from these lower animals, I don't see anything in those lower animals where we have this obsession to advancing technology. The technology we see in the bipedal primates that preceded us, it's basically constant. I mean, yes, we have animals that use tools, but we don't see them driven to advance technology like we human beings, literally from generation to generation. Okay, back to the supernova. Okay, we have got this amazing thing here. Let me jump ahead here. No need to take you through all this. Okay, here we go. Looking at these iron, cobalt, and nickel isotopes, Firestone was able to establish that these supernova events took place while we were still in the last ice age. So this is previous to the long, warm spring. So we see these, what we're seeing here is relatively frequent supernova explosions where the supernova are relatively close to the Earth. This is sufficiently close to the Earth where the radiation from the supernova event would have been damaging if humans at that time actually had global high technology civilization. The fact that they were simply surviving with these small mixed farms meant that humans could continue living. Although I also wonder if this may not have had a contribution to the declining lifespans that we see recorded in Genesis chapter 11, where we see humanity going from living 950 years down to living 120 years. Yes? Light years. Sorry, I had to abbreviate. Okay, that's how many light years away these things are. And what Firestone was pointing out, if the supernova is less than 900 light years away from us when it explodes, we're going to feel the effects. It's not going to bring about extinction like it would if you had Sirius go supernova. Anything less than 50 light years is really bad news. But anything less than 900 would be a civilization stopper. And so we had these events, but they're taking place also in an era where civilization would be stopped by the rapidly changing climate. And now we move into the era of the long, warm spring, and yes, we have supernova. And by the way, our ability to detect supernova is better because we've got technology. But these are the six known supernova that exploded during human history. So we're talking, say, the last 6,000 years. We have these six. And what I find interesting, look how tightly they cluster together. And we go before 1000 AD, we don't have any records of supernova events. And you say, well, maybe they weren't interested in supernova. Well, I would dispute that because we actually have records in the Korean literature, the Chinese, the Indian, the Greek, and the Egyptian literature, where they were recording nova events. Now, a nova event is thousands of times less spectacular than a supernova event. They're recording that, they're recording comets. Basically what they're doing in order to maintain their astronomical calendars and their astrological calendars, a lot of these civilizations were into astrology, worshiping the stars, they're recording unusual episodic events in the sky. So they would record comets and they would record nova. But when we look in their records, we see no supernova. All we see is novae and comets, which gives us the implication nothing happened during that era that would be as spectacular as what happened here. So, for example, this supernova eruption 2,000 light years away, it was bright enough you could see it in the daytime, much brighter than Venus. So everybody was seeing the supernova. Yes?
Without technology back when, how do we measure temperature when nobody's around measuring temperature? What are the cycles and how do we measure like the supernova?
Okay. Those temperature curves I showed you were from cores, sediment cores and ice cores. And what you're doing there is you actually got layers. So you know what year you're dealing with. Each layer represents a particular year in history. But in that layer, you're going to have certain oxygen isotopes. Oxygen 18, chromium, there's a chromium isotope which is correlated with temperature. So they're basically looking at these particular isotopes as a proxy for the temperature at that time. So that's where those temperature curves come from. And therefore, we really do know the temperature of the planet over the past 800,000 years. So we don't have anything older than that, although there's potential we might be able to get it back to 1 million years on an annual scale. Although there is a sediment core off of New Zealand that goes back 4 million years. However, the layers are not annual. They're basically every 100 years you're getting a layer. So it only gives you the temperature to plus or minus 100 years. And that is yet to be analyzed. But the next step is we're going to have a good temperature record for the last 1 million years. But already we got one for 800,000 years. Yeah, question.
Depending on the spread of the remnant shells of the nova, they're much slower than light speed, of course. Are there any predictions or things happening, or maybe some others that already happened along the road?
Well, I don't have the photos loaded on my computer. I do, but it would take me too long to find them. But for each of these six, we can see the supernova remnant. So, I mean, if you just were to Google those, up will pop a photo that astronomers have taken of each of these supernova. So every one of them, we can actually see what the supernova remnant looks like today. And in fact, this latest one in 1604, it was discovered at radio wavelengths. Because it happened behind an arm of a galaxy, it did not show up at optical wavelengths. So nobody in 1604 saw the supernova explosion. But it showed up at radio wavelengths, And now we've got an X-ray image and an ultraviolet image and a radio image of the remnant left behind. It's called Cassiopeia A. So in the constellation Cassiopeia, that exploded in 1604. Say, how did they come up with a date? They very accurately measured the remnant and the velocity at which the remnant is expanding, and they were able to calculate that it exploded in 1604. But yeah, of all the ones in the list, that's one of them. That's the one that nobody actually saw at the time. The others exploded in a place where they weren't blocked by the dust of our galaxy, and therefore they were visible. As I said, these are things that you could see in the daytime.
My question I never got to, would there be significant effects, electromagnetic or otherwise, from that shockwave hitting and getting inside the heliopause?
No, because it's so far away.
Okay.
It hasn't gotten to our heliopause yet because of the great distance, and by the time it does, it'll be so dispersed it'll have no impact at all. And that's my whole point here. Notice that these distances are quite large. The closest one is 1,560 light years. That's far enough away where it has zero impact on our capacity to launch and sustain civilization. It's got to be closer than 900 light years before it's going to have an impact. And most of them, the rest of them, are up beyond 2,000 light years. So we get nice photos of the remnants. And when they did explode, it caught everybody's attention because, hey, here's something in the sky besides the sun and the moon that we can actually see in the daytime. But it was only for a few months that it was that bright. And then it declined and became a very faint star. Yes.
So it caught everyone's attention like 1,560 years, before it occurred that far before we saw it.
Yes.
So, and then whatever's following after is slower. The debris.
The remnant takes a long time to expand. It's still, if you look at the Crab Nebula, you can actually see that it's been expanding. Because we've been taking photographs of the Crab Nebula now for 100 years. You can actually see it's bigger today than it was 100 years ago. And eventually it'll expand to such a degree that we won't even be able to tell it's there. In fact, if you look in the plane of our galaxy, you basically see a radiation pattern. That's the result of a whole bunch of supernova remnants blending together. In fact, it's difficult for us to find supernovas because of the background blending. So only if they're relatively recent are we able to see the remnants. And by the way, we can calculate how rapidly our galaxy is producing a supernova explosion. It's roughly about once every 50 to 75 years. Which is causing some concern for astronomers, because 1604, that's more than 400 years ago. We're way overdue for a supernova. There hasn't been a supernova anywhere in our galaxy for over 400 years. And yet we know that the historical rate is one every 50 to 75 years. And by the way, if you go back in deep time, say if you go back a billion years, then you got way more supernovas exploding than today. The supernova eruption rate is declining as our galaxy gets older and older. So that's another reason why you don't want to have animals before the Cameron explosion, because now you've got a supernova eruption rate that is going to be a little too extreme for those animals to be able to survive long term. And so not only do we have to wait for the oxygen content to come up, we also have to wait for the supernova eruption rate to decline. But the decline is very slow, and say we're looking at 50, one every 50 to 75 years. But yeah, this is an anomaly. Why nothing before 1000 AD? So from 1000 AD to 2000 BC, we got nothing. And from 1604 forward, we've got nothing. And it's basically an anomaly we astronomers are trying to figure out. Why do we have that? And why are these are all so distant? Whereas if we go back 20 to 50,000 years ago, we got a whole bunch that are quite close. And so if we go back to the previous slide, let me pull that one up. Sorry. No, back here. What you're seeing on this slide is the norm. This is what we should expect life to be like in the Milky Way galaxy, where you've got supernova happening about this frequently, where they're about this close to our planet Earth. But during the period of the long, warm spring, nothing. Nothing closer than 1,500 light years. Yes?
Hugh, this list here where they were much closer, would life on Earth have been significantly impacted from the initial shock of these?
If you're a cockroach, no problem. If you're a rat or a mouse or a rabbit, it's not going to be a problem. If you're a human being, it will be a problem, because now you've got sufficient radiation exposure that'll probably impact how long you live.
So was there some kind of partial extinction event because of these?
These are not close enough to cause anything. Like, I mean, in order to get a mammalian extinction event where you say you got a whole bunch of species of mice and rats and rabbits being knocked out, like what happened 1.8 million years ago, you've got to be within 100 light years. And some say maybe even within 50 light years for something. So this is sufficiently far away that no species of life went extinct as a result of the supernova eruption. However, it would be a problem if something like that close were to happen today, because now we got all these people and cities and, you know, communications networks set up that would be impacted by such an event. It wouldn't be the end of human beings, but it would mean a significant disruption in the level of our technology and civilization and our ability to grow food.
You mentioned to me last week that it might have been one of these supernovas that God is using to limit our lifespan.
Well, the problem is you've got radiation that lasts a long time from the remnants. And yeah, if you've got a lot of remnants decaying, that could maybe be part of the explanation. But I think a more significant part of the explanation is what was happening in the days after the flood. Humanity began to spread from these sedimentary plains into all the parts of the world. And they also began to trade. And part of that trade was the trading of granite material, you know, gravel and jewelry and so forth. And that stuff is loaded with uranium and thorium. So, for example, if you're a citizen of downtown Moscow, your lifespan is going to be about 5 months shorter than it otherwise would be, because Joseph Stalin loved granite. So he has all these granite skyscrapers everywhere. Well, there's a lot of radiation being given off by that granite. And for that matter, you might want to consider what kind of granite you've put into your kitchen. Incidentally, none of you are going to live long enough that if you're using the safe granite, it's going to be an issue. We've got granite in our kitchen. And so I wasn't concerned. I says, Kathy, we're only going to live a maximum 120 years. Let's not sweat it. And she loves the granite. It's beautiful, so we put it in. But I can tell you this, there's certain kinds of granite that you can put in your home that are really too rich in uranium and thorium. And so some people have thought it's always a good idea to test. And you can get one of these radon tests. That'll tell you what you're dealing with. Yes?
Do you look when it's pitch black and see if it glows?
If it's glowing, then I know it's not the kind of granite we want. But no, you're looking for very low levels of irradiation. So, but yeah, what you're looking at here is sufficiently close where it's going to damage the ozone shield of the Earth. And if you damage the ozone shield of the Earth, this is going to limit the amount of crops you can grow. So this is why if one of these things were to happen today, it'd be a real problem. Our agricultural productivity would collapse because of what this does to the ozone hole. Now, it's relatively brief. The ozone destruction is temporary. The ozone will be restored, but you're looking at many years. And during that time, you're not going to have the food to feed 7 billion people. So you're only talking a low population of humanity where they don't have organized agriculture, then an ozone shield problem. Because what they'll do is say, well, our crops failed, but we can go out and hunt some animals. Or we can gather some vegetables and berries or whatever. So if you've got people kind of just surviving on their own, they can simply adapt to the changing conditions. But for example, if you were to have one of these events take place today, look what it would do to India and China. I mean, they're very dependent on being able to grow as much grain as possible on their agricultural plains. And if you have a significant ozone hole expansion, then that's going to mean they're going to have probably only half the crops or a third of the crops they would otherwise would be able to cultivate, and that would impact the ability of the world to feed billions of people. But not a problem, because nothing that close has ever happened during the long, warm spring. All we got are these relatively few events. So, and I'm kind of glad these things happened, because these are really beautiful photographs. I mean, go online and look them up. They're gorgeous objects. And we've learned a lot about stars and our galaxy because of our ability to research these nearby, or these relatively nearby supernova events. Yes?
Time for a dumb question. That star went supernova 1604.
Right.
So that those photons have been moving towards us for, like, let's say 400 years or so. And if it's 2,900 light years away, how come we can see them?
Okay. It didn't erupt in 1604 AD. This is when we first saw the eruption.
Okay,
when it actually erupted is 1604, you know, 410 years ago, plus 2,900 years.
Okay.
So it's, you know, that's when it actually erupted, but it took light time to reach us.
Okay.
So yeah, please add all these numbers to these dates and you'll be able to figure it out. Yes.
Really smart question.
Okay. Are you guys got a little thing going here with one another?
I'm just jumping on his bandwagon. Smart question. Do Russians, because of all the granite, do you think they glow in the dark?
And they're so good.
And is that why Putin never has photographs in the dark?
Well, I think you should wear a shirt more often, because it will stop those electrons coming from supernova. And incidentally, just wearing a decent shirt and a pair of pants, that will be sufficient to stop the damage just from the electrons. Now, the protons will get through, but it's enough to stop the electrons. So yeah, it's a good thing to wear clothes when you're at the beach or riding a horse like Putin does. So maybe you can send him an email saying, you know, it'd be a good idea when you're riding horseback to have a shirt on. Okay.
Radar detectors can be filmed sufficiently. I'm thinking I'd like to get I've always wanted an Atlas Geiger counter, but now even more so. Check my granite.
Yeah, no, you can go to Home Depot or Lowe's and you can buy a radon detector, which will tell you whether or not you got the right kind of granite in your kitchen.
So it might take a little longer than radon gas. It produces radon gas.
Yeah, I mean, uranium and thorium decay will produce helium. It'll produce lead, but it also produces radon. So it'll give you a good idea. I mean, that's why they sell those things, so that people can figure out whether they should take their granite out and replace their granite, and Home Depot makes a lot of money. So, okay, no questions over here. Moving on. All right. A question I got asked last week. Why do we need ice ages? Okay, I mean, we have this ice age cycle, but why can't we just have a nice benign temperature and leave it at that? Why only 9,000 years? Couldn't God set it up so we could have millions of years of a nice long warm spring? And incidentally, that has happened in the past history of the Earth. So if I were to go back to this slide right here, this is not the only time where we've had a nice, steady, warm temperature at an ideal level for human civilization. The problem is, it was too long. You don't want that long, warm spring to be too long. You want it to be on the order of about 10,000 years. Why? Okay, this is what's really interesting about why God created human beings when we had an ice age cycle. Because in order for us to be able to enjoy the civilization that we're experiencing, we need to be here when we've got ice ages. Okay, what on earth do we need ice ages for? Well, lots of reasons. I'm only going to give you a few. But there's many reasons why it's crucial that we be here during an ice age cycle and not during a period when we've got millions of years of a nice, steady, ideal temperature. There are consequences when you got that nice, ideal, steady temperature and no ice ages. Okay. Benefits of, well, let me pull this up. Okay, Thanksgiving is going to be this month, and I'm hoping that all of you, when you celebrate your Thanksgiving dinner, are going to spend a few moments thanking God for the fact that we're in an ice age cycle. And by the way, not any ordinary ice age cycle. We are living after the most severe of all the ice age cycles. Okay, 2.58 million years, we've had this cycle of ice age, warm interglacial, ice age, warm interglacial, but it's been getting gradually more and more severe as time goes on. And we're here on planet Earth right after the most severe of all the ice ages that have happened during the ice age cycle. That's crucial for us to be able to launch and sustain civilization with technology and billions of people. And by the way, we're only talking about having hundreds of thousands of humans on the Earth. You don't need this. But if you want to have billions of people with global high technology civilization, you want to be in a warm interglacial where the temperature has that nice, constant, long, warm spring, and where the ice age that just preceded that is particularly severe. And yeah, the last ice age was way more severe than any other ice age we had before it. Give you an idea of the severity. I think I've got a map here which will show you. Here we go. Okay, at the height of the last ice age, and by the way, the height of the last ice age was just 21,000 years ago. So the ice age lasted 100,000 years, but during those 100,000 years, the temperature was doing this, and then the ice age reached a maximum 21,000 years ago. So, and this is how far it got. Okay, and went all the way down to the Ohio River. So it wasn't just Canada that was obliterated by ice. And by the way, what you're seeing here is that part of the ice age where the ice age sheet was a minimum of 1,000 feet thick. Okay, there is ice over all kinds of other areas, but we're not talking really thick ice. So this map only shows you the places where it was more than 1,000 feet thick. And how thick did it get? Well, parts of Canada, it got as thick as 4,000 feet. Also, parts of Siberia, it got to be 3,000 feet. Another place where it got especially thick, 4,000 feet thickness, was in Tibet. So, and so it gives you an idea of the extent of the ice. And by the way, wherever you've got a mountain range, you've got ice. So, for example, over the entire Andes, there was a big, thick layer of ice. That's another place where you get 1,000 feet or more of ice. And if you go to Africa, Kilimanjaro, and by the way, Kilimanjaro is not the only high mountain that is there. Mount Kenya is over 17,000 feet. Kilimanjaro is close to 20,000 feet. That was all glaciated. I mean, Kenya, all of Kenya, well, most of Kenya is above 8,000 feet. That was a glaciated plateau back at the time of the last ice age. And so even in the tropics, by the way, you go to New Guinea, which is right on the equator. New Guinea also has mountains that are 17,000 plus feet high. The ice covered those mountains. So no matter where you go on planet Earth, 21,000 years ago, you had nearby heavy sheets of ice. Now the biggest one was over Canada, but also you got Siberia, and notice that the ice age that impacted Europe went all the way down to just above Crimea. So that's kind of the tropical place where the Russians go for their summer vacations, but the ice age literally crept all the way down to the Black Sea. And all of the Alps were covered, and a good more than just the Alps were covered. And, you know, these are different mountain regions. They're also, we're talking 1,000 feet more or ice. By far the most severe ice age that's happened in the past 2.58 million years. And by the way, winter sea ice actually went down below San Diego. San Diego was icebound in the wintertime during the last ice age. Yes?
If we were looking at a map of the South Pole, would it look the same for South Africa and southern South America?
Okay, if you look at the southern hemisphere, the ice age covered all of Tasmania. and a good chunk of the province of Victoria in Australia. So Australia was also impacted by the last ice age. If you look at South America, if you look at Chile, from about half of Chile was totally covered in ice that was 1,000 feet thick or thicker. All of Antarctica was covered. Today, there's actually rocky parts of Antarctica. But back then, not only was all of Antarctica covered, 1,000 feet thick of ice, but a good chunk of the ocean around it. So much bigger than we have today. And also, there was ice in South Africa, just tiny portions of South Africa. The biggest ice in Africa was actually right at the equator, where you got that high plateau and those high mountains. But that's another interesting thing about the planet in which we live. Notice the mountains tend to be highest near the equator. And if you look at North and South America, the highest mountains are near the equator, and then as you move away from the equator, they get less and less. So look here at Mexico, the United States, and Canada. Look at the Rockies. What you see in Mexico is the mountains are 17,000 plus feet high. You get into the United States, they're 14,000 plus feet high. You get into Canada, they're 12,000 feet high. So you've got this declining mountain elevation, which is actually ideal for making sure that you've got melting ice to water the plains. So one of the big benefits, let me pull this back a bit, of having an ice age is you got meltwater. Now, what if you didn't have melting water? And by the way, we're still getting the benefit of water melting from glaciers that will hold over the last ice age. So, for example, the water that's making it possible for agriculture in the Mesopotamian Valley, it's coming from melting glaciers that survived the last ice age in the mountains of Ararat. Mount Ararat is a glaciated mountain, and there is a slow decline in the amount of ice as a result of melting, but that explains why the Tigris and the Euphrates are flowing today. They got snow and ice melt that allows those rivers to flow 12 months of the year. Whereas two other rivers mentioned in Genesis 2, the Gihon and the Pishon, have stopped flowing. Because during the last ice age, you had a thick pack of ice over the mountains of the Arabian Peninsula, but because of the warming of the planet, all that ice is gone. There is no more ice pack over Arabia. And so the Gihon and the Pishon today are dry rivers. But for Adam and Eve, there were rivers just as big as the Tigris and Euphrates. And the text tells us that the four rivers met together in the Garden of Eden. Well, only two of those rivers are flowing today. But those rivers are flowing because of glacier melt from the last ice age. Now, if you look at the continents, let me pull you back to this one. What if you didn't have all this ice? Well, for example, if we had been without that ice for a million years, most of North America would be a desert, and you wouldn't be able to grow anything on the plains of North America. That would also be true of China and India. And if you look at Eurasia, now, whenever you've got a landmass that's really big like this, you've got a lot of land that's far away from the ocean. And if it's far away from the ocean, you're basically not going to get adequate precipitation for crops. But what makes India and China so productive is they had the benefit of the melting of the glaciers of the Himalayas and the Tibetan Plateau. And so that allows, you know, great rivers to flow. In fact, that I recorded, there's over 20 major rivers that flow out of the meltwaters from the Himalayas and the Tibetan Plateau. Keep in mind, the third largest store of ice on the planet is here in Tibet. First is Antarctica, second is Greenland, third is Tibet, number four is the Arctic ice cap. There's actually more ice here than there is in the Arctic ice cap. And it's because of that huge quantity of ice that you've got the Ganges, you got the Yellow River, you got the Yangtze River, and it's because of those great rivers that you're able to have such a rich production of agriculture here. Now, that's one factor. You need rivers flowing from the melting of the glaciers to provide the water to grow the crops on land masses that otherwise would not be able to sustain the crops because there simply wouldn't be enough water. The second factor is you need those agricultural plains to be fertilized. Now, take the Tibetan Plateau, for example. Notice that you have this huge quantity of ice thousands of feet thick, and over a few thousands of years, that melted away. And by the way, when you got aggressive melting like you had from 21,000 years ago to, say, 10,000 years ago, not a good situation for agriculture because you got way too much meltwater. You're basically getting all these floods. However, there's a benefit of those massive floods from the melting of the glaciers. They bring silt. And so you've got these great alluvial plains, and that's what makes the plains of China and India so agriculturally rich, is that they've been fertilized by all this alluvial silt as a result of this extremely rapid melting of the last ice age. I mean, we're talking a period of just 10,000 years where we go from thousands of feet of ice to hundreds of feet of ice or no ice at all. So it's very aggressive, and that resulted in the movement of huge amounts of silt into these agricultural plains. In addition to that silt movement, you've got wind-blowing dust. And what's happening is when this ice melts, this weight of ice is taken off the Tibetan Plateau. What happens to the Tibetan Plateau? It rebounds. And so as you remove the ice, the Tibetan Plateau goes up and the agricultural plains go down. Because when you've got a huge amount of ice here, that pushes the Tibetan Plateau down, gravity, and it causes these agricultural plains to be pushed up. So over a period of 10,000 years, this region dropped and this region went up. Say, by how much? We're talking thousands of feet of rebound of the Tibetan Plateau. So the Tibetan Plateau today is about, what, 17,000 feet, 17,000 feet above sea level. During the height of the last ice age, it was depressed down to 11,000 or 12,000 feet. So you got thousands of feet of rebound, and that rebound results in the depression of the Indian subcontinent and the Great Plains of China, basically pushing them down to just hundreds of feet above sea level, which is optimal for being able to cultivate this area. Now, when you also have that much elevation change, it generates wind. So you got the melting ice, and you got this elevation change, a rebound up, a drop down. It generates very strong winds. So for thousands of years, you had strong winds blowing off of this plateau that newly got exposed. So it was covered with ice, and today we have ice along the Himalayas, but basically the Tibetan Plateau is ice-free. But when it becomes ice-free, these very powerful winds take material off that Tibetan Plateau and blow it all over China and India and also in this direction towards the Russian steppes. We're out of time. Yes?
Has anyone estimated what the sea level drop was during that period? And could that explain why Eden was dry then? Then when the ice started melting, then Eden got flooded? And, I mean, is that...
That's been calculated. I'm going to tell you that next week. Because what I've told you is basically two of the benefits of living right after an especially severe ice age. I got eight more. I thought I could get them all done today. I didn't. So we'll get to that in 2 weeks from now. But, I mean, that's two reasons why our planet is so agriculturally productive. We've got these great rivers from the melting of the last ice age, plus we got all this alluvial silt that resulted from the aggressive erosion that followed that, and plus this wind-blowing stuff. But really what it took was this rebound. Plateaus going up and plains dropping down, generating these winds, causing water to rush down and to bring all this nice nutrient-rich silt and wind-blowing dust. And by the way, I haven't told you this,